All right, welcome back everyone to the deep dive. You know, we often talk about some pretty complex legal concepts here, and sometimes it feels like we're getting into the weeds, but today we're going back to basics a bit, back to the fundamentals. We're going to take a deep dive into something that affects all of us every day. Well, hopefully not directly every day, but something that underpins a lot of our legal system, something we should all understand.
Yeah.
The Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, absolutely. And specifically, it's protection against unreasonable searches.
Right. We're going to be focusing on the warrant requirement today. And to really illustrate how these protections work in practice, and sometimes where the lines get blurry, we're going to examine a really interesting Supreme Court case. This is Groh v. Ramirez. It was decided back in 2004, and it really digs into the question of when law enforcement can be held accountable, you know, liable for errors in search warrants.
Yeah, this case is a great example of how even seemingly small procedural missteps can have huge consequences. It really gets to the heart of the Fourth Amendment's purpose and, you know, the limits on government power.
So the case revolves around a man named Joseph Ramirez in his ranch in Montana. Back in 1997, a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives agent, that's ATF, named Jeff Groh, had reason to believe that Ramirez might be possessing illegal firearms and explosives on his property.
Right. So he goes through the process, applies for a warrant to search the ranch.
And here's where things get interesting. Groh actually prepares a super detailed application. It's got a really thorough affidavit laying out exactly what he suspects is there, even listing the specific items he's looking for.
But, and this is crucial, the warrant itself that's issued and used for the search, that document only describes Ramirez's property, like the address and the boundaries. It leaves out any mention of those firearms or explosives he's supposedly looking for.
Right. There's no list. And even more importantly, the warrant doesn't incorporate the application or the affidavit. So those documents with all the details, they're not attached. And the warrant doesn't say, hey, see this other document for the list of what we're looking for. It's like totally separate.
Imagine you're Ramirez, right? You get this warrant. It says they can search your property, but it doesn't say for what. It looks like they're basically being given free rein to just search for anything.
Right, which is a huge problem. That lack of specificity is exactly what the Fourth Amendment is designed to prevent.
Right. And, you know, as it turns out, the search is conducted and they don't find anything illegal. So the Ramirez family sues. Their argument is that this search, conducted with a warrant that was missing this really basic element of listing what they could seize, that this violated their Fourth Amendment rights.
So it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And that leads us to, I think, some really important questions for our deep dive today. First, did that warrant, just by not listing those items, did that violate the Fourth Amendment? And second, even if the warrant was defective, could Agent Groh be held personally responsible? Or is there some kind of legal protection for law enforcement in this kind of situation?
Right. Those are the big questions. And to really understand the court's decision, we need to talk about something called the particularity requirement.
Yeah, particularity. So what exactly is that? It sounds straightforward, but I'm guessing there are some nuances here.
Yeah, definitely. So the Fourth Amendment itself, it says that warrants have to particularly describe the place to be searched and the things to be seized. This particularity requirement, it's not just some technicality, it's there for a reason.
Because if they could just show up and say, we're here to search your house, they could be looking for anything, right? Like, what's to stop them?
Exactly. It prevents those fishing expeditions, right? Like rummaging through your belongings, just hoping to find something, anything to use against you. Back in the day, before the American Revolution, the British used these things called general warrants. They were really broad, and they basically allowed authorities to search anyone and anywhere they wanted for any reason.
So that's what the founders were trying to prevent when they wrote the Fourth Amendment.
Exactly. They wanted to make sure that any search had to be justified, that it was reasonable, and that it was limited to specific things. So this particularity requirement, it's a key safeguard against that kind of overreach.
So that's the background. What did the Supreme Court ultimately decide in the Ramirez case?
Yeah.
Were they sympathetic to the family's claim?
They were, yeah. The court ruled in favor of the Ramirez family in a 5-4 decision. Justice Stevens wrote the majority opinion. He basically said, look, the Constitution is super clear. It states outright that warrants have to particularly describe the place to be searched and the things to be seized.
So because the warrant only said where to search and not what to search for, it was unconstitutional.
Right. The court said it only did half the job. They said, hey, you had all those details in the application and the affidavit. Why wasn't that good enough?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. You'd think having that information somewhere would be enough.
It's a good point. And the court acknowledged that those supporting documents, they might establish probable cause, like why they believe illegal stuff is there. But they said that doesn't satisfy the particularity requirement that has to be in the warrant itself.
So it's not enough to just have that information. It has to be right there on the warrant.
Right. Unless, and this is important, unless the warrant specifically says it's incorporating those documents by reference, it has to basically say, look at this other document for the list. In this case, that just didn't happen.
That's so interesting. So the court's saying that the warrant itself has to stand alone. You shouldn't have to go digging through other documents to figure out what they're allowed to look for.
Exactly. The court actually called this a facial defect in the warrant, meaning the problem was obvious just from looking at it.
So they're saying the warrant basically turned into one of those general warrants that the founders were so worried about.
Exactly. And the Fourth Amendment prohibits those outright. The search, they said, was presumptively unreasonable. And they were really clear that even if Agent Groh was acting in good faith, the fact that the warrant itself was invalid meant the search was basically like a warrantless search, which, as we know, is a big no-no.
Okay, so the warrant was defective. But what about Agent Groh himself? I mean, he was just doing his job, right? He got approval from a judge, so shouldn't he be immune from any kind of liability?
Right, you're talking about qualified immunity, which is a legal doctrine that often protects government officials from being sued when they're acting in their official capacity.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like we hear about that a lot in cases like this. So did qualified immunity protect Groh in this instance?
Nope, it didn't. And this is actually a really significant part of the decision. The court said, no, qualified immunity doesn't apply here. And their reasoning was that the error in this warrant was so glaringly obvious that no reasonable officer could have missed it, especially since it was Groh himself who filled out the warrant in the first place. I mean, we're not talking about a typo here. This was neglecting to include a fundamental part of what makes a search warrant constitutional.
So they were basically saying he should have known better.
Pretty much. The court emphasized that qualified immunity isn't a blanket protection. It doesn't shield officers when they violate clearly established constitutional rights, and they do it in a way that's objectively unreasonable.
So basically, ignorance of the law is not a defense, especially something as fundamental as the particularity requirement in the Fourth Amendment.
Exactly. You know, there were actually some dissenting opinions in this case. Not all of the justices agreed with this really strict interpretation.
Really? Who dissented and what was their reasoning?
Well, Justice Kennedy agreed that the warrant was defective, but he disagreed on the issue of qualified immunity. He felt that Groh's mistake was a good faith error. He argued that Groh had followed the proper procedures. You know, he submitted the application to the magistrate and even verbally explained what he was looking for when they were conducting the search.
So Kennedy was saying Groh shouldn't be penalized for an honest mistake.
Right. And he even questioned why an officer should be held liable when a judge had reviewed and signed off on the warrant. I mean, shouldn't the judge have caught the error, too?
That's a great point. So where do you draw the line between a simple mistake and a blatant disregard for the Constitution? Where is that line, in your view?
It's a tough question. And it's one that courts grapple with all the time. In this case, the majority drew that line at the point where the error is so obvious, so clear-cut, that any reasonably well-trained officer should have recognized it. They weren't saying that every minor mistake would automatically mean no qualified immunity, but leaving out the entire list of things they were searching for. That, to them, was a major flaw that any competent officer should have caught.
So if he had just put a sticky note on there that said "see attached," he might have been in the clear.
Well, not a sticky note. But yeah, if the warrant had referenced the affidavit and it was attached, things might have been different.
Right. So the devil's really in the details here.
Absolutely. And this case shows how important those details are. Okay. So we talked about Justice Kennedy. What about the other justices who disagreed?
Yeah. Weren't there a couple of others who disagreed with the majority?
Yeah, there were. Festus Thomas, joined by Justice Scalia, actually went even further than Kennedy. He actually argued that the search was totally reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, even though the warrant was defective.
Really? Even with that huge omission, how could he justify that?
Well, he felt that the magistrate had looked at the affidavit and approved it, and he said that active judicial authorization alone was enough to make the search reasonable, even with technical problems in the warrant. He basically felt that the focus should be on whether the search was reasonable in the big picture, not just whether the paperwork was perfect.
So a more practical approach as opposed to strict adherence to the letter of the law.
Exactly. But the majority disagreed. They stuck to that more textualist interpretation. They emphasized that the Fourth Amendment literally says what it says. You need to specifically list the items you're going to seize in the warrant. They thought that allowing the supporting documents to replace that particularity requirement, it would basically gut the Fourth Amendment protections.
That makes sense. So for all of our listeners out there who are trying to wrap their heads around this case, what are the big takeaways from Crow v. Ramirez? If we could boil it down to three key points, what would they be?
All right, three key points. First, and we've said it a few times, but bears repeating, particularity is non-negotiable. You have to list exactly what you're searching for right there on the warrant. It's not enough for it to be in some other document unless the warrant specifically incorporates that document.
Got it. So be specific.
Right. Second, and this is important for law enforcement, qualified immunity is not a free pass. Just because you're a cop doesn't mean you can ignore the Constitution. If you make a mistake, especially a really obvious one, you can be held accountable.
Checks and balances, right?
Right. And the third key point is that even though a judge signs off on the warrant, that doesn't mean the officer is off the hook. The officers still have a duty to make sure that the warrant is constitutional.
So it's a shared responsibility.
Yeah. And this case really shows that even seemingly minor procedural errors can have huge consequences.
It's all about the details.
It really is.
You know, as we're talking about this, it really strikes me how this case shows that tension between the power of the government and the rights of individuals.
Yeah.
It's like the court is saying, look, we have to be super careful about authorizing the government to go into someone's home.
Absolutely. And it really highlights the importance of the Fourth Amendment and that particularity requirement.
It's a reminder that our rights aren't just theoretical. They have to be protected in a very concrete, practical way.
Right. And for anyone who wants to go into law enforcement, this case is a great illustration of why you need to understand these procedures inside and out.
Okay, so thinking practically, what steps do you think law enforcement agencies could take to make sure something like this doesn't happen again? I mean, how do we prevent these kinds of errors in the future?
I think better training is key. Make sure officers understand the Fourth Amendment, the warrant requirements, and the importance of particularity. Maybe have a checklist or something to make sure they're not forgetting anything important.
Like a pre-flight check.
Exactly. And make sure judges are paying attention, too. They're the ones signing off on these warrants, so they need to be just as diligent about making sure they are constitutional.
So it's about everyone in the system being aware of these issues and taking responsibility.
Right. And that goes back to one of our key takeaways. It's a shared responsibility.
You know, I was thinking as we were discussing this, and something occurred to me. What if they had just knocked on the door and asked Ramirez if they could search? Would that have been okay?
Well, that's a whole other can of worms. Consent searches are complicated. It's not just about asking. It's about whether the person really understands their rights and if they are truly giving consent freely and voluntarily. But that's a topic for another deep dive.
Yeah, I think you're right. We'll save that one for another day. But it's a good example of how these legal issues can be really tricky.
Absolutely. The Fourth Amendment is full of interesting and complex questions.
Okay, so as we wrap up today, let's just reiterate those key takeaways one last time. First, the warrant itself needs to specifically list what they are searching for. Second, qualified immunity has limits. And third, both the officers and the judges have a responsibility to make sure that warrants are constitutional.
Right. And remember, even though this case is from 2004, it's still really relevant today. It shows us how important it is to be vigilant about protecting our Fourth Amendment rights.
Absolutely. All right. So for everyone listening, here's a final thought to consider. Does the Groh decision mean that the police officer who prepares and serves the warrant has the primary responsibility to make sure it's constitutional? Or is it more on the judge who reviews and approves the warrant? Or maybe it's a shared responsibility. What do you think?
Yeah.
And what are the wider implications for accountability in our justice system when these kinds of fundamental errors occur?
Yeah, those are tough questions. And there are no easy answers, but they're definitely worth thinking about.
Right. We encourage all of our listeners to keep exploring the Fourth Amendment and its impact on your lives. And as always, thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Thanks, everyone.